Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements. And it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning Duration Shingles offer ultimate protection. Choose from 26 stylish colors and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicles. And well, sir, upon reaching the 50th episode of Chronicles, I decided it best to cover Sharp's eagle. That's my style, sir. And here with me today is Bo and Samson. And we're basically just going to have just a hugely good time talking all about Sharp.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not more complicated than that. We're just going to have a damn good conversation talking about Sharp's eagle, the first novel that great writer, historical fiction writer Bernard Cornwell wrote back in 1981. And then since then, of course, has gone on to, led to ITV's incredible series with, of course, Sean Bean. Yeah. He's very proud of his hardback, ladies and gentlemen. He feels the need to model it in high definition. But we're going to talk about all of that. We're going to talk about Sharp's Eagle and the actual first novel as well. And yeah, like I say, just have a bloody good conversation about Sharp, because this has been requested for some time. Every now and then I just see a comment, when are you going to cover Sharp? When are you going to cover Sharp?
Every time you quote it on the main podcast, there's always a couple of people like, Luca, he hasn't done Sharp yet.
Yeah.
Please, can you tell him to do it, please? Please.
Yeah.
I'll get around to it.
Well, you finally got your wish then, haven't you? You bastards.
Plus, also, it's very good. That's a very good bean you've done. Also, the real Peninsula War, right? I'm here for the real Battle of Talavera and everything.
Yeah.
Because on my channel, History Bro, check that out, I've done the first, I think, four novels, but chronologically through Sharp's life. So I started with Sharp's Tiger.
Mm.
And then I did, Sharp's Fortress, Sharp's Trafalgar, I think. Three or four of them. But not this one, because this is actually, in terms of chronologically through Sharp's life, it's about a third of the way through. But it's, as you say, it's the first one Cornwall wrote.
Yes.
Which is remarkable. I'm sure you're going to talk all about it, but it's really remarkable how much of the lore is already there.
Mm.
But anyway, I'll let you lead the discussion.
Well, no, not at all. It's interesting to just come to that exact point, that when you read the preface, I don't know if it's in probably the preface of all of Sharp's Eagle, but he talks about the fact that he really wanted to write. He was obviously fascinated by the Peninsula War ever since he was a young boy, because, and the Napoleonic War more broadly, because he was a huge Hornblower fan growing up. He loved the novels of C.S. Forrester. But at the same time, he was like, well, there's all this naval fiction. Where's the one for the army? Where's the one that gets to tell the tale of Talavera and Badajoz? And that's what he wanted to do first. He wanted to write this novel about Badajoz, which I believe ends up being sort of like the
Sharp's
backdrop of
Company,
Sharp's Company.
It's the third book he wrote.
Yeah. But he was like, I've never written a novel before, so I just need a bit of a run-up at it first. I just need a few practices. And so this is what, so he put Sharp into 1809, Battle of Talavera. And the if I've got the history of it right, that the British, the first main thrust into Spain to try and with Wellington's army to try and dislodge Joseph Bonaparte. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there's way more to it than that. I mean, before the retreat to Coruña, we're in the middle of Spain.
Of course.
But still, I suppose after defeating the French in Portugal, The Peninsula War is a real ding-dong back and forth, basically, is what it is. It's not the first time English troops are in Spain, but still, okay.
Yeah
nonetheless. Because that's the thing that I love the real history, right? Sir Charles Oman's history. I always talk about Oman, don't I?
Yeah.
But he's, and I quote him a lot for my monarchy stuff, but his real magnum opus is the on the Peninsular War, and that's the best stuff I've on Epochs, where I did an nine part series on Napoleon. Two or even three of those episodes are just on the Peninsular War, which is completely too much. If you're only doing nine parts on all of Napoleon, spend a third of that on the Peninsular War. Mm. Just suggests that I'm fascinated by the Peninsular War. But yeah, I mean, what a first novel.
That is so good.
What a ridiculously great first novel. Mm. Like, unbelievably good for a first novel. And anyway, it is odd, though. Well, not odd. He could do whatever he wanted, of course. But in hindsight, it looks kind of weird that he started it there, of all places. Why there? I mean, he's probably explained it in an interview, but I've not seen it. But yeah, why there, of all places? Because, of course, he goes back to, like, the retreat to Corunna, and he goes back and he does the Battle of, like, Vimiero. I don't know if there's a book about Ronica. I don't know. But anyway, to start it sort of just before the Battle of Talavera, why there? I don't know. But it works. It's fine, isn't it?
It does, yeah.
There's no problem with that. Yeah. Perhaps Cornwall was particularly fascinated by Talavera. I don't know.
Well, in the foreword or preface, he specifically states he wants to start with the Battle of Badajoz. Yeah, I'm intentionally not pronouncing the Spanish or the Portuguese correctly. I will not apologise. but yeah, he wanted to start with that specific battle because it interested him particularly. Siege, yeah. And said, I'm not worthy of starting with that, essentially. Right. I want to build myself up. So I don't think specifically Talavera that interested him. It was just an event that happened before Badajoz.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
And it just that's just how the cookie crumbled.
Mm. Yeah. But to write a novel like this where, if anyone doesn't know, like the last third, the second half, the last quarter anyway, is the Battle of Talavera.
Mm.
And there's quite a few subplots in it, aren't there?
Oh yeah, many. It's quite a meandering book in that sense. A lot like when we first read Patrick O'Brien's Master and Commander. There's a lot of weaves. There's a lot of just little moments in it as well that can get lost. And you think, oh no, that happened and that happened, because it's actually a very action-packed novel.
It's much faster paced than the TV show, I thought.
Yeah.
Because I've watched Sharp's Eagle, the Sean Bean TV thing.
Yeah.
Like three or four, maybe five times, and rewatched it at weekend just gone for like the fourth or fifth time. And it's sort of slower than the book. How is that possible? And they change it around a fair bit for the TV show, don't they?
Mm, yes.
There's a whole couple of subplots they just don't bother with, and a couple other bits and bobs they tweak and move around and do a bit differently. But that's the prerogative of a screenwriter, okay, whatever. But I thought it was quite slow. The TV version.
Mm.
There's a few bits in it where I'm like, okay, get on with it. Okay. Whereas the book's not like that. Well, I don't find it. The book's a real page turner.
No, it's the first time I've read a smaller novel like this in a while where I haven't been able to put the book bloody down.
Mm.
Whereas when I watched, because I only read this a couple of months ago for the first time, I then went and watched the two first episodes of the Sharp TV show. I haven't watched any of the others yet, but Sharp's Rifles and then Eagle. Sharp's Eagle. I won't mention Rifles here because it's a bit spoilery, but the actual episode of Eagle, it feels like a lot has been sliced away and chopped around, because a lot of the stuff in the later episodes relies on various other things that have been chopped and changed around. And I think that the book is a far better medium for this story.
It's much better. The book's much, much better.
Mm. Though I do adore the show.
Yeah.
I do adore the show.
I love the show, but like...
Really enjoyable, yeah.
But
first time watch, it was, honestly...
Sit down and get ready for it. I mean...
It was an authentic adaptation of Sharp's Eagle, but the book still capped it off.
One of the things I suppose we'll end up saying is just that because of the limitations of budget and TV, though, one of the things that you really do see is not 20 men charging across the field and being like, oh, yep, that was Talavera. Like, when we get to the final battle, like, the scope with which he describes it with is genuinely impressive. And for him to be able to coordinate across all these different paragraphs, just all the different troop movements and who's going where and everything is like very masterful.
Oh, he
like you can tell he can rotate the Battle of Talavera in his mind like the apple. Yeah. You know. So
no, he cares. He really cares about being true to reality, even if Sharp and Sharp's company are not real.
Mm.
He has done his utmost to make a story that could theoretically fit into reality.
Yeah.
And he cares so deeply about that real history that I'm sure you'll tell the story about the cannons later on the show.
Yeah,
I mean, we'll get the South that. Essex isn't real. Yeah, I mean, I would love, I obviously, to make it clear, I love the TV shows. I was actually a kid when they was on TV.
Right.
Like, very early teenager, 12, 13 or something, when they're first on. And so they're part of my childhood. I can't praise them enough. But I will make one or two criticisms, which is, well, the main one, which is really obvious as soon as you watch it, is that the budget wasn't big enough to have loads of extras.
Yeah.
Because the Battle of Talavera is no small affair. It's not one of those giant Napoleonic ones where it's hundreds of thousands of sides.
Mm.
Well, it's something like 45 to 55,000 a side, something like that.
Yeah.
That's no small affair.
No.
But they've got like 30 extras a side, something like that, yeah. in the TV show, and it's like, this is supposed to be the Battle of Talavera.
And this, it's a little field in the middle of Crimea, and it's, it doesn't really look like Talavera
like
at all.
At most they've got 50 extras aside, haven't they? Something like that. But anyway.
So
let's not get ahead of ourselves.
No, let's begin by just talking about. So exactly, they've had the flight from Corona before all of this has, of course, happened. That the British have been on the back foot, of course, all of Napoleon's marshals are obviously about Spain. And we just, we're originally greeted with this fanfare of the British troops marching through a Portuguese town. And obviously everyone's very much cheering. And the way that Cornwell just sets up very concisely where you are in the war and what's going on and like who's got the upper hand. It's all done really, really clean. And then you're immediately just brought into the life of Richard Sharp. Mm. Now, obviously, despite Sean Bean's iconic Yorkshire voice, and I truly can't imagine anyone else for the part at this rate, and honestly, neither could Cornwell by the end, who obviously, after writing about 10 Sharp novels, ended up, I think, sort of like trying to integrate the version of Bean's version of Sharp into the novels because he, whenever he was writing Sharp, he heard Bean's voice, he saw Bean's physicality. And so it was an incredible way that those two became one and the same. But for now, he was, so Sharp is born in London as the son of a prostitute and an unknown father. Has no idea who his father is. Cornwell commented one time that he thought, to be mischievous, that he might make Sharp's father French, but he decided against it and decided it would have just been too silly. But Sharp is obviously coming from that background, someone who has, of course, come from the ranks.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously there are previous novels describing his life as a private climbing all the way to where he is now as Lieutenant Sharp. But Sharp is a man who is desperately, he's ambitious. He wants promotion. And he's very resentful of the upper class aristocrats because of the privilege that they have. But I suppose one thing to say about Sharp is that that resentment is, it's very much a resentment based on envy. It's not an actually, oh, we shouldn't have these things and this is all terrible and people get to go fox hunting and they get to drink claret at the table and talk about, you know, things in polite society. It's not that Sharp actually hates these things. It's just that he feels inept and he feels like an outsider whenever he's brought into them. And there's this sort of like inner fight, this sort of like working class grit within his character that is kind of like, I'll show them, I'll climb that high. And when I do it, it'll be purely based on merit, not because someone's bought a colonelship or whatever it may be.
Well, the vast majority of the first few books is him fighting against that system.
Mm.
All of the officers around him are people who've bought their way in or who have been grown up in absolute privilege and just been handed stuff for free. They've been handed the officership, handed the captaincy multiple times. He's just basically completely overridden and gone, no, your battlefield honours mean nothing compared to this guy who spent however many £1,000, give or take, for adjusted for inflation, for that role or for that...
Commission.
Yes.
You can buy a commission. Yeah. Well, it's not just the first few books. It's all the books.
Yes.
That's hard baked into Sharp at all levels. You've mentioned quite a few things there. So to begin with, yeah, he's always described as from London.
Yeah.
Tall and dark, black haired or dark. Sean Bean's none of those things.
No.
He's actually blonde, not particularly tall, and an author. Yeah. But yeah, yeah. I mean, I know Bernard Cornwell said in interviews and things that he loved Sean Bean as the TV version. And after a while, after those came out, he just started writing it more for that.
Sharp became Sean Bean.
Yeah.
After the
for
show
Cornwell.
Came out. And I'll tell you,
which is great. It's funny. It's great.
The audiobook version I've been listening to over the weekend, that whoever's voice acting that is putting on the Northern accent as hard as he possibly can. Although it does sound a bit derivative. After a while, but also that same voice actor attempts Irish accents as well.
Right, you will hear no Irish attempts from me today, ladies and gentlemen.
You've mentioned a few other things as well worth picking up on. I'm pretty sure I've seen Cornwell say this, or if not, I've imagined it. Either way, it seems to be true that what he loves first and foremost is Wellington.
Mm.
Even though the story is about Richard Sharp,
yes,
and the chosen men of the 95th or whatever. Really, it's a vehicle to talk about Wellington.
Mm.
because, you know, even the first stories are Wellington in India. When you look at it that way, because there's a few of the Sharp novels where Wellington's not in it at all.
Mm.
Somewhere he's in it loads more than this one. And he's in this one a bit, isn't he? Not all that much, but a bit.
Yeah.
Like every now and again, you see Napoleon, or Cornwell actually does a scene with Napoleon, but usually Napoleon's not in them at all. Well, I mean, it's the Peninsula War, and after Sir John Moore's retreat to Corunna, like Napoleon's not even in Spain. So, and I believe Sharp's Devil is an exception to that. But anyway, it's really a way to the whole Sharp thing is a way to just explore really Arthur Wellesley.
Yes.
So he's a fan of that first and foremost, and I love that. Whenever in any Sharp book, when you get a bit of Sir Arthur, the Lord Wellington, that's just great, right? You love that bit. It's like, we got a Wellington scene.
Yes. I've been waiting. No, he is essentially Sharp himself. Is sort of an avatar for us as a layman to see what it was like to be under. In Wellington's campaigns in the Peninsula War.
And get to meet him sometimes or be in his presence from time to time.
It's almost like someone reading a newspaper serial at the time going, oh, what's Wellington done this week?
Yeah. Mm.
But instead, you're in the Peninsula War basically achieving all the cool things that Wellington does. Sharp is the one who's behind a lot of those, as it turns out.
Well, Sharp's a classic example of that sort of literary device where you put one of your characters everywhere of interest.
Mm.
And Bernard Cornwell, like, completely unashamedly does that. Okay. I mean, Sharp's Trafalgar is stupid. I love it. Crazy example of that. It's just, I'm just going to contrive the thing. So he's at the Battle of Trafalgar. Okay. Yeah. So anything that's of interest in the Peninsula world, just Sharp's there.
He does that for most of the other books. The ones he writes retroactively, he's like, how can I get Sharp to be at this other interesting thing, even though I've already written a story that happens at the same time as this? Mm. Actually, I'll just move some dates around.
I've seen some people say, like, how can Sharp be at that particular battle or engagement when in an earlier book you've already said he's over there, and Bernard Cornwell was like, I don't care, don't worry about it.
It's a fast bastard, isn't he?
Yeah, it's fiction, I've made it up, it's up to me, don't worry about it.
Literally,
it's
like, fair enough then,
yeah, no, cool, good.
His quoted as saying, these are my books. Yeah. I can do what I want.
Yeah. It doesn't have to completely make perfect sense. Like, for example, there's one later novel where it says Sharp had never met Daddy Hill before, but he totally has.
Right.
He 100% has. And when, again, like a fan asked Bernard Cornwell on like a forum or something, it's like, I don't care. but anyway, so one of the things you said about getting back to the novel itself, what Bernard Cornwell's brilliant at, I think, honestly, world-class, brilliant. And it's amazing, this is his first novel. is how he deals with exposition. Because that's difficult, to do a little bit of exposition which isn't clunky.
Yeah.
And doesn't take you out of the story.
Especially for someone who they may not know the history, you know, behind it. They're not just natural history buffs like you.
Yeah, this, like me, when I first read this, I expected to be bombarded by a complete barrage of historical terms, like giant paragraphs about historical troop movements, all of that. I got none of that. Everything was explained in a really simple to understand but really interesting way, which made me want to learn more. But it also didn't treat me like an idiot for not knowing it. So,
but that thing of like starting a novel, because the first page of a novel is absolutely critical to make people want to read it, or like unbelievably critical. So that magic sort of literary sensibility to introduce characters, start a novel off, start a book off, and the exposition isn't clunky, the introduction of the characters isn't clunky. In fact, it makes you want to read on. All those things, whatever that is, if you could bottle that and sell it,
yeah.
If you could teach people that, everyone would be writing and selling best-selling novels, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
But obviously, here's what I'm saying, Cornwall's like a master, a true master of it, where you never think, like even for a second, you think, oh, okay, I've got it, boring. Come on, get on with it. Not a touch of that.
No.
Or, as you say, like really difficult like terminology that you're supposed to understand and you don't know and you have to go off and find out what he really meant by that. Or, starting in the middle of the Peninsula War, well, third of the way through it or whatever.
Yeah.
And that you're not like, wait, I really need to know why that is, or how did we get here? Whatever that magic touch is to make the reader just go, okay, I'm just on board with these characters now. And what's happening now? Yeah, I need to know what happens next.
Yeah.
Whatever that is, Bernard Cornwell's just the master.
Well, yeah.
He's just the master.
Sharp's Eagle specifically is great because the entire first paragraph of chapter one, not the foreword or preface, is basically him going, oh, those Portuguese, they love the British. The British are so cool. Can you see how cool the British are? The Portuguese love them. That's essentially, and I was like, oh, yes.
Still true to this day, I've heard.
Yeah. Well, our alliance goes back to what, the 12th century or something?
Yeah, it's like 1350 something.
Oh,
right,
okay. But yeah, nonetheless, that thing of how you make someone in the middle of Sharp's career, in the middle of a war, in the middle of a troop movement. And it just works. You're just like, okay.
Yeah,
I'm on board. So
yeah.
It's superb writing, novel writing.
Absolutely. And so Sharp is already at the beginning of the novel. He's been injured. He's got maggots at his leg and he's being nursed back.
That's how it starts. He's in the middle of... He's just been wounded. You don't see that.
No.
And they don't elaborate either. They just say a French officer did this to him.
But he's being nursed by the ever dependable, everyone's favourite Paddy, Patrick Harper.
Pat.
Yeah. For the old Pat. And obviously Harper is just incredible. Harper is such a constant, loyal companion. There's a part in it, isn't there, where it says they were as close to friends as it is possible for a lieutenant and a sergeant to be. You know, it does bear in mind that difference of rank means there has to be a little bit of distance and formality there. However, in a private conversation with one another, just as a confidant, they're absolutely, inseparable from one another. And this is what you constantly see when... And one of the things to pull up about what you were saying, Samson, about is that when you've got all of these British officers there as well, because that's the thing as well, so many of them, it's always the British officers who are getting in the way, right? They're always incompetent. Sharp is always the one having to, like, save the day and bring it. But really, this isn't actually based on sort of any sort of like subliminal, like class conscious subversion from Cornwell. It's really just like the mechanics of how a story has to function. Because originally, before he'd written the novels, Cornwell had said, well, obviously the French should have been the bad guys, but I found as writing the story that it's very hard to just constantly bring Sharp into contact with those characters. He spends most of the story surrounded by other British officers. And so that's where the conflict has got to be. It's got to be with the people that he's constantly surrounding himself with. But I think it's this thing that it goes to show you as well the fact that Sharp's not just the one who talks the talk, he walks the walk, because Harper and Hagman and all of his chosen men are so loyal to him, you know, and you see why they're so loyal to him. Very, very quickly, within just this one single novel. And so his character comes across very, very pragmatic, very strong, with his own firm, they're not gentleman's morals, but he does have very strong morals of his own.
Yeah, one thing I would say about Sharp, if you read enough of the novels, you get it, is that he's a violent murderer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you see that in this
like,
one.
Hornblower is a good boy.
Yes.
He's a Hornblower is a gentleman.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yes. And he does everything, nearly everything, by the book, and is a nice, pleasant person. Who's the master and commander?
Oh, Jack Aubrey.
Yeah, Jack Aubrey and his friend.
Oh, Stephen. Yeah.
Again, they're good, honourable, nice, decent officer men. Richard Sharp will drag you into a darkened alley and cut your throat and not care. Like, he's a killer.
Yeah.
He is an absolute killer.
Yeah.
And unapologetically so. Harper as well.
Yeah.
Harper as well. But then there's that magic of making someone that is really sort of morally kind of a baddie, but you're just he's 100% the hero and you 100% root for him. Of course you do.
Yeah.
The fact that he's a badass only adds to how much you love him.
Yeah, of course.
But he's not nice. He's not nice at all. So, I mean, that's one thing. One of the other quick things, one of the main things, that he came up from the ranks. He came from nothing. And how rare it is for an enlisted man to ever get a commission of any type. And even if you do, you'll never have been born a gentleman. You just won't have done.
No.
And then the various class things. Again, a lot of the novels, I wouldn't say formulaic, that's unfair, but a lot of the novels are similar in the broadest sense of the Sharp gets in trouble for being such a badass, essentially.
Right.
And the officer class look down their nose at him and in the end, he turns the table on them all and wins everything and wins the day and he's the best.
Mm.
Basically that.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again and said it at the different battles of the Peninsula War, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, the theme of his own officers are the things that stand in the way. Often the French in Sharp novels are sympathetic.
Mm.
Often they're the baddies nominally, but often they're actually noble and worthy opponents and stuff.
This is particularly prominent in one of the early battle scenes in Sharp's Eagle, where the French, when they encounter the British in something in the battle we'll talk about a bit later, in the aftermath of the battle, the French are honourable in their post-battle communication. They treat each other like human beings in comparison to this book's major villains.
Yes. Yeah. Which we will get to in just a moment.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.